Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Again, I want to remind everyone that we Zoom our show on Monday, and you will be hearing this Tuesday because this is our Tuesday edition. We begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified during the impeachment hearing of 2019, where he assured his father that it would be all right. Well, of course, we've come to know nothing is all right under the reign of Donald Trump. And in fact, for Colonel Vindman, he and his twin brother were escorted out of the White House, I believe in February of 2020. Now hear the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. Have those words ring in your ears as you either get a mail-in ballot or show up and vote in November of 2020.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I woke up early Monday morning, and I realized I wanted to talk to someone about what happened in Minnesota and in Minneapolis. And for those of you who don't know, I went to school at St. Olaf College. I went to work in Minneapolis. I worked in the IDS building. I lived on Loring Park. I actually did talk radio for the Hubbard family in Minnesota. So Minnesota is very near and dear to my heart. And when I woke up, I realized, you know who I need to talk to? I need to talk to Dave Schultz. I figured if anybody was front and center to this whole story, it would be Professor Schultz. He is a political science professor at Hamline University. He also teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. And I thought, wow, this is a guy who probably will be able to sort of share with me what it feels like and sort of his sense of the sort of challenges facing Minnesota and Minneapolis. And then Dave Schultz, who's now joining us, agreed to join me. And then he sent me a series of articles. And suddenly I realized, oh my God, he's my deep throat. It turns out he's taught about this whole issue. My understanding of Minnesota and Minneapolis is so not real. And I want to welcome you to the program, Dave, and I'm so grateful that you're here. And I want you to start by giving us a sense of your personal geography of where you live, let alone discuss with us what you understand about this. But I want to just read three sentences from the piece that you wrote at the New York Daily News. And this is really important because I think this is what was so surprising to so many of us, but it shouldn't have been. Minneapolis and Minnesota generally enjoy a national reputation for liberal tolerance. Locally, what is known as Minnesota nice. Yet this Minnesota nice masks decades-old racial disparities that parallel the problems this city has had with the police use of force against Blacks. And then, let me just read one more sentence. Minneapolis is a city with horrible racial disparities. And from there, that sort of sets the stage for our conversation. And I want to welcome you to the program and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Now, let me discuss to you physically where I am located, where my house is. And if the listeners could almost take out a piece of paper and draw it, they can capture it. Approximately 5 miles to the west of me is the place where George Floyd was killed. North of me, about 2 miles, is the Midway area of St. Paul. And I mention that because we, of course, have all heard about the demonstrations and the unfortunate destruction in Minneapolis that occurred after his after his killing, but in St. Paul, in what's called the Midway area, there were nearly $100 million in damage also to the buildings and businesses. To the northeast of me, about a mile, is the governor's mansion. Northeast, about 3 miles to me, is the state capitol. All around me, a couple of weeks ago, we could see the smoke rising from two different directions. Our house was rocked by the explosions that were occurring in St. Paul. In the morning, we could smell burnt oil and plastic. And then when the governor finally called out the National Guard, our neighborhood was part of the staging area for what? The armored vehicles, tanks, and everything that would be patrolling the streets. And as the demonstrations were occurring in St. Paul at the governor's mansion, the helicopters were flying over our house. That's physically where I am located.
So in your piece, you share with the audience of the New York Daily News that you, in the early 2000s, you taught a class on police, civil, and criminal liability, when they could be held liable for their behavior on constitutional violations, including excessive use of force. Now, listen to this sentence, everyone. I want to make sure you hear every word of it. Minneapolis was a living laboratory in what police should not do. Should not do. So Dave, as you were smelling it and seeing it and hearing the response and seeing the murder of George Floyd, 8 minutes and 46 seconds, of all the people on the planet, you were probably the least surprised.
I was not surprised at all. And I want to tell one other story too. Back in the 1990s, I worked at the University of Minnesota at the Institute on Race and Poverty with an amazing team. John Powell, who used to be the chief legal counsel for the ACLU, headed it up. And we did a study in Minneapolis in the 1990s that upset everybody when we found out and concluded and told people that Minneapolis was the third most segregated city by race and class in the United States. It was up there with Chicago and Detroit. So we had that going on. We knew it back then. We also knew when I was teaching this class on police, civil, and criminal liability that the city of Minneapolis had a history, even then, that went back decades of police officers with impunity using excessive force and whether deadly or other forms against police. We knew well before George Floyd that Minneapolis had severe racial disparities in terms of housing, healthcare, education, incarceration, and the criminal justice process, all reinforcing one another. And not to sort of overuse the Charles Dickens line of A Tale of Two Cities. Minneapolis was the tale of two cities. If you were white, if you were affluent, it's a wonderful place to be. But if you were black, you were stopped and harassed by police, victims of excessive force, put in schools that were substandard for you. And so when George Floyd was killed, I was not surprised. It was a time bomb waiting to happen. It was, and this is the part that should scare everybody. It was also about how the clock had run out. Not just the clock about what, 5 years ago or 6 years ago, Ferguson and Michael Brown, but it was about how Democrats had talked a good game about race, but hadn't delivered. And that's going to be one of the messages here, too, is that it was building up the frustration, building up the anger. And finally, it all exploded with George Floyd.
So David, one of the things I've been listening to and hearing is that so Barack Obama put in all these things that police should do, sensitivity training, all this kind of stuff. And you even say that the relatively new chief of police was pretty good and have been trying to institute some of these things. But it appears that That's not what the problem is. You can be as sensitive as you want, but if there are these huge gaps of wealth and segregation and education and healthcare and all these things, the fact that you have a sensitive cop can't in any way, shape, or form help to address what is clearly a just yawning failure within the state of Minnesota and especially the city of Minneapolis. And that has nothing to do really with the police. The police are almost a reflection of the failure, but the failure is so much deeper than that. And as you point out, you issued that report in 1998. They knew. Yeah. They knew. The question is, why did they do nothing?
Yeah, and that's really the good question here. You're absolutely correct, is that we knew through several mayoral administrations, through numerous council members, and they did nothing. This current mayor, Jacob Frey, runs for mayor criticizing his predecessor, Betsy Hodges, saying she failed to address police brutality. And he said, if elected, I'll address it. He gets elected and largely does nothing also until now. And even then, not much. And so it's a partly a story about how we can't just give lip service to issues. We actually have to deliver. But the other thing I want to bring up here, and I always talk about this in my classes, is that when we think about racism and policing, yeah, there's bad cops. There's no question that we've got the bad cop who's a racist pig. And if that's all it was in the world, let's get rid of all the racist cops, it would be okay. But there's two levels that are even deeper. Minneapolis has police culture, institutional racism that goes back almost a century. But yeah, even more is what you're hitting at here. It's an institutional racism built into a larger societal racism about, like I said, education, housing, a whole bunch of other things. And as we're debating police reform, and there's no question we need to do that. Yeah, it's good that we're going to ban chokeholds. It's good we're going to tinker with a few things here and there, but we shouldn't kid ourselves into thinking that that's going to be enough, that there's going to be need to be a deeper set of societal institutional reforms if we're going to reform the issue of police brutality against African Americans and people of color.
And David, so in the piece that you wrote at the Daily News, what I think is so shocking is, you know, some of the things that you write about, I would have assumed you were describing Alabama. I would have assumed you were talking about Tennessee. Mm-hmm. What is so depressing is that you're talking about Minnesota, because it's not just Minnesota nice. You get this idea of kind of the Scandinavian sort of more social network that, you know, that they're more enlightened with their policy. And you, I mean, these numbers that you put into your piece are just more than depressing. A 2013 Minnesota Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights found an unemployment gap for blacks to be three times that of whites. A 2015 report by the Center for Popular Democracy found this gap to be the second worst among states in the nation. And then a Census Bureau study described Minnesota as having one of the highest black-white gaps in median family income in the nation.
Yeah.
And I hear that and I'm thinking, oh my God, what is happening here? And there was a attorney talking about the murder in Georgia, and he made a really interesting statement. Who do you trust anymore? I'm not even sure what trust means. And reading your piece, that's exactly how I felt. Who do you trust? It's not partisan, because these are a lot of Democrats that have been in control. And you said they pay lip service, but they don't deliver on the policy changes that make a difference in people's lives.
Yeah, this is the scary part, is that this is on so many scores, what really a crisis of what? Almost like Democratic legitimacy. I mean, part of what happened, and I want to partition off the legitimate peaceful demonstrations, you know, from the the fires, the bombings, et cetera, et cetera. The people who hit the streets demonstrating were basically saying, we've had enough. And the people who are now saying, defund the police. What defund the police really means, I think for most people, is not that we're getting rid of the police, although there are some who are saying that. It's saying that we need to rethink policing. Why? We no longer trust the police, our political institutions, to be able to perform and represent us. And that's what's happening in Minneapolis right now, is that in many ways, the political system there has become delegitimized. And that's scary.
Well, and so it's really interesting. So I called you because of George Floyd. And then, of course, over the weekend, we have this whole horrific situation in Georgia, in Atlanta. And I kept thinking, there is something wrong with the culture of the cops, but there also is this racist response. And I want to go to the man that was killed in Atlanta. And that is, if I was found asleep at a Wendy's, I know they would have said, who is your husband? Let's call him up. Let's have him pick you up and take you home. I know they would have done it. Why? Because I'm a white woman. I know it. Because I've had interactions with cops where I've just watched how they kind of sort of pat me on the head. You know what I mean, Dave?
I do.
And they sort of go, and they act almost like a social worker and yes. Not like a cop. And yeah. What is so disturbing to me is that you keep saying we need social workers to respond. We need mental health workers. There are a lot of cops that have social worker skills, but those social worker skills, for whatever reason, seem to come out when they're dealing with white people. But when they're dealing with people of color, then it becomes more bombastic, more militaristic, more it's black and white. And they kind of, all those good skills seem to disappear because they see color and they don't see a person.
I think you're right. I was going to say, you and I do this all the time. I can walk down the street and see a police car come and I can wave and the officer will wave back to me. To me, a police car is not threatening. If I'm black and I'm in Minneapolis and I see a police car coming, it is not something that I smile and wave at the police officer and say, ah, it's good that the police are on the street keeping me safe. It is a reason to be scared. It is a reason to worry at this point. And you're right, is that many of the police officers, certainly not all of them, many police departments have adopted what I call the new school of policing, which is about what? It's about communication skills. It's about de-escalation. It is about those skills. But there still are many police departments that have the old approach, but even those that have adopted the new approach. You're right. It's a different police force for people who are black versus people who are white.
Absolutely.
Well, just the whole mindset of police officers is different for black people and white people. I mean, you know, Arnie made the point about the officer, if she was asleep in the car, patting her on the head. White males like me and Dave don't get quite the same patronizing approach that women do, which is outrageous in and of itself.
I know.
But still, the idea of shooting a white person is just something that I don't think police really, that's not the go-to thing that they do, but they would view it with something that is really pretty much a last resort, I think. Yet with black people, I mean, you see these videos all the time of people, including this guy, even though he had a tussle with the police, he's running away and they shoot him dead. There's no chance in hell that they would do that to a white person, or the guy who was caught with, I forget his name, with a taillight out or something, and right. The police
in New Jersey
wrote a report saying he took their taser, but he never did, and he's running away, and you could see the officer shooting, you know, half a dozen shots in his back while the guy is just running away, and then he writes a report saying, I was in fear of my life. I mean, that if he was white, there is zero chance that the officer would have shot him in the back like that.
But it's more than black and white, though, Dave, because I think that's what's so depressing about the pieces that, you know, you were in the New York Times, there was a Minnesota Post piece, and you write about the culture of complacency. And I think that's what, we're at a tipping point, Dave, because, you know, all the platitudes and, you know, Amy Klobuchar, nice woman, you know, she's, you know, true grit. And yet she was a Hennepin County prosecutor. She was one of those people who could have done something, but didn't. And I almost think that they don't have a sense of urgency that things need to change. And I don't mean just urgency in prosecuting police, Dave, but urgency in addressing the healthcare disparities, urgency in addressing the education disparities, urgency in addressing the wage disparities. It's all those things. They're screwed every time you look. And then you see them shot, you go, oh my God. And I'm thinking, well, in a lot of ways, they've been shot before, but you didn't see it. It was called the healthcare shot. It was called the education shot. It was called the wage shot. It was called the housing shot. You know, they walk around alive, but yet the differences are so dramatic, Dave.
You're right. I want to do a connection here.
Okay.
In 1967, across the United States, we had, we'll call them race riots across the United States, significant problems in terms of urban unrest.
Right.
President Johnson appoints the Kerner Commission. Kerner Commission, among the most famous lines in it, we have two nations, separate but equal, black and white. The Kerner Commission was supposed to be a call for addressing social justice. 52 years later, the conditions that gave rise to the Kerner Commission report largely exist in the United States to this day. That we have failed with what, a half a century now, if not longer, warning about racial discrimination, disparities, concentrated poverty.
Right.
We're basically where we were 50 some years ago. And what scares me now is that there is this moment now to make change that I fear will be lost.
So will it be lost because the politicians can't find the political will? Will it be lost because Donald Trump will be able to, you know, work the divide so effectively that there's a chance he could win? Will it be lost because we're so overwhelmed with this pandemic and this climate change that we don't recognize that in a lot of ways, both the pandemic and the climate change actually enhance our ability to actually address all these disparities? Because if we're going to move forward in addressing this healthcare debacle, if we're going to move forward in addressing climate change, this is the perfect opportunity, Dave, to also address these racial disparities. We can actually create a whole newness that actually includes equality.
Yeah, there is a potential here and a need for a fundamental restructuring of our society, whether it's on healthcare, whether it's on education, whether it's on race relations. And when you said which of those reasons why it might not happen, it could very well be all of them. It could be the fact that what? That Donald Trump will use this occasion, much like Nixon did in 68, to say the problem was what? Law and order, that we need to crack down. Yeah. It could be a sense of overwhelmingness, a sense of fatigue. There could be lots of different things. And so what I worry about is all that. I also worry, and this is part of the point I've been making, is that if we simply focus on policing and say, ban a chokehold here, or require a little bit more warnings there for police. Yes, it makes a little bit of change, but it's cosmetic compared to the broader things that we really need to address in our society.
Might make us not succeed at this moment to make real change. What do you think that any of us, excluding the administration, can do to make us have a better chance at real change?
Well, the first thing has to be you've got to vote. You have to vote. You have to be out and do that. The second thing, I think all of us have to be rethinking the question of for my, it sounds going to sound philosophical in the sense of what is justice? What is fairness? How do we think about this across race? How do we think across generations in terms of applying this? And I know this sounds maybe more sort of, again, philosophical, as I said before here, but at some point we need to be having a society that, when I say more thoughtful, it thinks through these problems and doesn't just sort of take the quick and easy knee-jerk reaction on something, but asks, what do we really need to do to make the kind of fundamental changes that our society demands for us? And so I think maybe because I'm an educator, education is always a good thing to do.
And let me just say something. So I read the New York Times piece that you're in. Minneapolis police use force against black people at 7 times the rate of whites. And you know, and this is all about police. This is the New York Times. Well, this is the simple solution that you were talking about. So this is what we have to do. We have to get rid of chokeholds. But the most important piece you wrote is the one that you wrote in the Daily News, The Ugly Truth About Race in Minnesota. Because that's the one that really shows all the underlying rot. All the underlying rot. And people, I was shocked when I read your piece, Dave, because I did have this impression of when I left Minnesota in the 1970s of what it was like. And to read your piece was just so disheartening because it never occurred to me that these kind of racial gaps and segregation and unemployment and education disparities were true there. And when you understand that, then you understand what happened with the cops. But you have to understand your piece about the truth about race in Minnesota. And that is what we all need to learn, because if we understand that, we'll understand our responsibility to make much bigger change than just dealing with the police force or defund the police. It's a whole reorganizing about the kinds of investments we need to make, and we better start making them the day after the election.
You're absolutely right. It's understanding the linkages, linkages across multiple things, because again, the big point that I made, it's not just about policing. It's about what? In the 70s, we used to talk about what? Institutional justice, the fairness of our institutions. We need to be thinking about that again.
Dave Schultz, I am so glad I woke up at 5 a.m. and sent you an email. Dave Schultz is a professor of political science at Hamline University. He also teaches at the University of Minnesota Law School. I will make sure I post every one of his pieces. But the most important piece is the one you wrote, The Ugly Truth About Race in Minnesota. It is a wake-up call. What you think about Minnesota ain't true. What we need to fix is described in every single bit of injustice that you point out in your piece in the Daily News. And that was really important to understand, because it really is about all those racial disparities and not just bad cops.
Yeah, that's a really important thing for all of us to take away from that.
Exactly. Thank you so much for joining me, David. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye.
All right, everyone, stick around. We'll be right back, and we're going to be talking about LGBTQ issues. But today's a great day. You'll find out why.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day John L. Lewis called miners who worked for Little Steel Coal subsidiaries out on strike. It was an act of solidarity as conditions worsened on steel strike picket lines. The walkout was designed to force the closure of steel mills by stopping the flow of coal. 10,000 workers in as many as 19 mines owned by Republic Steel, Bethlehem Steel, and Youngstown Sheet and Tube dropped their tools. Bethlehem had not been one of the independent steel companies initially included in the Little Steel Strike, but workers at its Cambria Works in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, walked out in sympathy with railroad workers at Bethlehem-owned Blacklick and Connemaw Railroad. They had been refused a contract. Striking miners in Johnstown marched to Cambria Works to join the 7-mile stretch of picket lines. In Ohio, the Canton Federation of Labor voted unanimously for a general strike if the newly formed Citizens League attempted to force reopening of the steel mills. SWAC leader Van Bittner threatened to call out another 600,000 miners by week's end if the strike was not settled. John L. Lewis remarked, quote, "Labor is menaced by the force of arms of Republic Steel Corporation. Labor is calling attention to this situation so the law, government, or public opinion can begin functioning before another massacre takes place." UAW President Homer Martin added, quote, "It is our purpose to spread the light of democracy to every part of this land until autocracy and industrial slavery have been driven from the country." But Johnstown civic leaders and town officials had formed a citizens' committee and prepared for battle as the miners approached. It seemed there was no end to the anti-strike violence. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. 'Cause the loser now will be later to win, for the times, they are a-changing. From senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't lock up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing. The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I remind you always that we Zoom this show on Monday for it to air on Tuesday. But that's why the get that I have right now is even better, because who knew? We're going to be joined by Caitlin Burns, who is the first ever openly trans Capitol Hill reporter. She grew up in New England. She covers politics and LGBTQ issues and reproductive health policy. Now, let me explain how we got Caitlin. So I am going to Vox.com, and I see this piece, and I went, ooh, this is great. Trump rule allows doctors to discriminate against LGBTQ people. No, that's not great. But I was like, well, this is perfect. I want someone to explain the inhumanity of the Trump administration, especially at this point in time. And so Caitlin's piece was totally appropriate. And then a decision comes down with the Supreme Court today, Monday, a 6-3 decision. And I'm like, oh my God. And we have Caitlin Burns on the air with us. So Caitlin, welcome to the program. Let everyone know why I am so over the top, over the moon at a decision by the Supreme Court, not only because it was 6-3, but that this decision was penned by Neil Gorsuch. So yeah. I'm like, checking my pulse. So welcome to the program, and explain to everyone, which they probably have heard because a lot of us are just enthusiastic everywhere. What did the Supreme Court decide today? And to a large extent, I think a lot of people are shocked, but incredibly pleased. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm happy to be here. It's funny. The circumstances of today make the original discussion we had last week about coming on just kind of a totally different vibe. But
totally different vibe, exactly.
But the decision today is really incredible. I would argue that it is more important than the Obergefell decision legalizing marriage equality. I think people would probably dispute me on that. Yeah. But my reason for this is, in the U.S., everybody needs a job. And before this decision, it could be legally argued that it was perfectly legal for an employer to fire an LGBT employee just for being LGBT. And now, thanks to the court's decision, that is no longer considered legal under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So I think this decision will end up affecting a lot more people in the U.S. than the marriage equality ruling. And it's also the first really, it's the first ruling on trans rights at the Supreme Court in the United States in the country's history. So I think those two things combined, I would say, puts it right up there, at least with Obergefell, maybe higher. It's really a historic day. And of all people, it's Neil Gorsuch who is writing this decision. I am maybe not as shocked as other people. So I attended the oral arguments back in October in DC at the Supreme Court. And if you go back and read the oral arguments and you see what Gorsuch said, he actually said on a textual basis, the case is close, right? And when I heard that, my ears kind of perked up because I'm like, you know, Gorsuch is a textualist, you know, a justice. There might be a small chance, but I'm like, but he was appointed by Trump. Like, he was appointed to make this decision the way religious conservatives and social conservatives wanted. I said, there's no way he's going to do this. He'll find some, like, hoop to jump through. There's no way. And you know, we wake up this morning and it turns out he's actually a textualist, which is really remarkable. I think we're all just in shock. And I think even more shocking is that John Roberts joined with the majority in this case to make it 6-3 and not 5-4.
It gives me so much hope about the Supreme Court that Donald Trump thinks he owns and the Supreme Court that we have. And I think it was really smart of Roberts to make sure that Gorsuch wrote the decision and not him, because it's much more powerful that mm-hmm. a Trump appointee wrote the decision. Yeah. Mark Stern, I just quickly grabbed his article at Slate. I haven't had a chance to read it, but there was one comment where he referred to Gorsuch's, I think it's 26-page decision, as a breezy decision. He uses the word breezy. I'm like, what? It was like, it's like such a funny word to use. It's so Mark, you know. I'm glad, and he even pointed something else out. So there's obviously three dissenters, you know, Alito, Thomas, and Kavanaugh. And the other thing he points out, and again, I haven't read these because this is all happening in real time, and I did not expect to have you, and I'm just beyond thrilled. But he said so. Kavanaugh wrote a separate dissent. And it was almost like what he said, and I think I read this in his tweet, that Kavanaugh was sort of saying, congratulations to the LGBTQ community, but I disagree. I mean, it's like, excuse me? I mean, it was like, what are you talking about? And one of the things that Ken reminded me is that both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh were both clerks of Kennedy, mm-hmm. which is so interesting. So you've got Gorsuch writing the decision and you've got Kavanaugh complimenting the decision, even though disagreeing.
Yeah,
it's almost like he still feels like he owes something maybe to Trump and to the.
Or Kavan, do you know if Gorsuch was clerking for Kennedy when he wrote any of the or decided on any of the gay rights cases?
I don't believe he was. I think they were both already federal judges by that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would have come earlier.
The first one too, the sodomy case?
Oh, that one I'd have to double check on. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, I want to remind everyone that I reached out to reporter at Fox, Caitlin Burns, and she also writes for The Guardian, and she's the first ever openly gay Capitol Hill reporter, and openly trans Capitol Hill reporter, and not knowing that this decision would come down. Let me just go back to something you said at the very beginning, because you think this is more important than the marriage decision. And I completely agree with you. And let me tell you why I completely agree with you. You can live not married. You can't survive unemployed. You can't survive if you can't go to work. And I always tell the story that many years ago, I was in a 60-minute special called Faith and Politics with Dan Rather. This is in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And there were four segments. My family was in one of the segments. But one of the segments is a segment that took place in Texas. And what was going on was that it was a commitment ceremony of gay couples, even though it was illegal, but they were in this church and they could at least openly say, I love you, and sort of perform a quote unquote marriage, but not a marriage that was legal with all the legal benefits. Outside of that church were pickup trucks and burnt crosses and Confederate flags and people going wild outside the church. So at the end of the 60-minute special, I turned to my little daughter, who at the time was like 9 or 10 years old. And I said to her, so how do we do? You know, like talking about us. Mm-hmm. Because we were okay, Mom. And then she turns to me and she says, but I'm confused about the segment about Texas. And I looked at her and I said, what were you confused about? And this is what she said, Caitlin. How can anybody hate anyone for loving someone?
Yeah.
She was 9 and a half. So I knew that that aspect was going to change because my daughter's now in her 30s and that we've come to understand that. But this one was really important because, you know, because this was about a law that had been written years before. And it was about an interpretation of what does sex mean. And I am so glad that sex means you.
Yes. Can I just add that another reason why this decision is so important, and I don't think Obergefell, I think Obergefell was important also because of its reasoning. You know, the humanity, we're all human, crying out loud. But the reasoning in this case is going to affect a lot of other cases in a lot of other areas other than employment. You know, the reasoning was that anybody who has any animus against gay and lesbian people or any animus against trans people, it has to be based on some gender bias because of a stereotype of the way you think women or men should be behaving. And these folk, they don't have those same feelings as we expect the stereotype to be. And so that reasoning, there's a lot of cases where gender discrimination is a big issue that gives people a lot of rights. And I think that with this reasoning in this case, LGBT people are going to start making inroads in all those other areas as well.
So, but that's where I want to segue into why I originally called you, because I'm wondering if it has any impact on that decision by the Trump administration. Again, I want to remind everyone that I actually called Caitlin Burns to comment on her piece at Vox. Trump rule allows doctors to discriminate against LGBTQ2T people. And I am thinking, is there any way we could sort of take this and sort of, I know it's about employment and this is about health, but is there a way for us to begin to sort of at least challenge this regulation, this rulemaking, based on the decision that just came down from the court?
Yeah, I expect that we're going to see this again litigated because everything in this country gets litigated. So what happened on Friday is the Trump administration finalized the Health and Human Services rule, which defines sex as based on biology, meaning whatever, you know, genitalia you were born with. Because of that, if you discriminate against a trans person, let's say, because they're trans, they said that's not discrimination because you're allowed to treat, you know, people who are born with penises as men and, you know, people who are born with vaginas as women, and that's not discrimination. But I think that this it will provide a building block towards rolling that back through the courts as well. I think I'm less hesitant than others to sort of jump on the, oh, you know, Trump's anti-trans and anti-LGBT agenda is toast because of this. I think I hesitate on that just because, you know, the cases against that are probably also going to last years. And we don't know what the court is going to look like, you know, whenever it comes back to the court.
I really think that the reasoning of this, that LGBT discrimination is necessarily includes sex discrimination, gender discrimination.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cases where gender discrimination is given a lot more serious consideration than LGBT protection.
No, it's incredible.
You know, Hobby Lobby wouldn't have happened if it were women.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This decision has got huge ramifications. Huge.
I'm hesitant to say, you know, this dooms all of the Trump administration's agenda, but it's a step in the right direction, right? It's establishing that trans people can be discriminated against on the basis of sex according to civil rights legislation, and it'll provide sort of a legal building block down the road.
So, Caitlin, explain to me exactly, play this out for me. What does this decision by the Trump administration on Friday really mean? I'm trans.
Yeah.
I have to go to a doctor. What happens? Does the doctor say, oh, I can't treat you because you're coming in as a female and I see that you're a male or whatever, and therefore I will not treat you, or I will treat you as a male and not as a female? What exactly does this mean? Does this mean you can shut the door? Does this mean you can turn them out? Does this mean that you ignore your Hippocratic oath? I'm just trying to figure out, what does this really mean for the purposes of healthcare?
Yeah, it's both, actually.
Okay.
Which is really awful. I mean, obviously it's dependent on how you interpret it, but okay, you know, through a broader interpretation, it was definitely both. And there have been high profile incidences of trans people, you know, dying because doctors refused to treat them. So one case was Robert Eads. I forget the exact date, but he was a transgender man, mm-hmm. and he got ovarian cancer, and he went to an oncologist and got all the tests run, and then never heard back from the doctor's office. And so a couple months went by, and he called, somebody actually called him. Like a nurse called him and said, how are you dealing with your diagnosis? You know, we haven't heard from you. And he goes, what diagnosis? And she's like, oh my God, the doctor never called you. So he called the doctor, and the doctor said, you know, honestly, my first instinct was to send you to a psychiatrist, not to treat your cancer. The guy refused to treat his ovarian cancer. Several other doctors also refused to treat his cancer, and he died of ovarian cancer. There was another case in Washington, D.C., just miles from the White House in the early 90s, where a trans woman was in a car crash and was seriously hurt. The paramedics arrived and they started administering first aid, and she was unconscious, and they cut open her pants as part of, you know, the procedure,
right.
And saw that she had a penis, and they basically stopped treating her and just basically laughed at her. They refused to touch her all the way to the hospital. When she got to the hospital staff ignored her, and they gave her some medication to like pacify her, but she ended up, you know, bleeding out in a hospital bed while people ignored her. So that ended up going to court, and the jury found with the family of this poor woman, obviously, because it's horrific. But there was a medical expert who testified that because of the drug cocktail they gave her and the state of her condition, she would have died experiencing absolute terror. They ended up awarding millions of dollars. And it really became a rallying cry in the nation's capital to reform the district's non-discrimination policies to include transgender people. So this is potentially what you're looking at going back to under the Trump administration, although I think their public information offices would deny that that's the situation they're creating. That's a very real fear for trans people.
You write in your piece. I mean, I read those stories and I'm horrified, and I'm thinking about what they can do. And yet there is sort of an added sense of hysteria and urgency. And what you write is, in the age of COVID-19, the rule could also mean the life of a sick trans person is quite literally at the whim of a doctor's personal belief about trans people. That fear was already permeating the trans community before news of the finalized rules was released. Quote, "I'm scared to say this out loud, but I'm afraid that trans people will face things like being deprioritized for ventilators or for care," says Brad Kidman. As I'm reading this, but it's not only that. Understand, this is a highly contagious disease. Again, this is like so stupid because you're cutting off your nose to spite your face because you think, I'm not treating you. But what you were doing is you were sending someone who could in fact be incredibly contagious back into the public where all those not gay, you know, trans people could actually get the disease from a gay trans person. So what have you done? You know, it is both shocking and beyond cruel, given the times we are living in, because it is so not thoughtful.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just one of, frankly, many missteps in responding to the pandemic that the administration has done up to this point.
So this isn't going to affect till August.
Right.
Is this something that could be overridden by states in the sense that it's a rule and regulation coming out of the Trump administration, but if a state established a higher policy or non-discrimination policy and said to doctors and whatever, you know, I'm sorry, but you have to treat everyone. Can they basically sort of, you know, flip the middle bird?
Yeah, so there are state level protections against this, but unfortunately, and I don't have the number off the top of my head, I apologize, but I think there's something like 17 states that, and it could be less, that have healthcare protections for LGBT people.
And would this also apply in insurance? So that if you're seeking health insurance, that in fact you could also face this form of discrimination in health insurance?
Yeah, so we could potentially see a return to the days when health insurance plans had blanket exclusions on transitioning procedures, like surgeries and hormones. We could go back to the days when being trans is considered a pre-existing condition. That's, of course, if the law is wiped away altogether, which will be a separate Supreme Court case. We could see the days of, you know, trans or gay people being charged more for their premiums. We've seen in the past where HIV drugs are placed in like a lower priority coverage bracket so that, you know, it could potentially get charged more for it. So there's a whole cascading series of awfulness that follows behind this. I would be very surprised if it isn't stopped by a federal court, especially given
what just came down.
Yeah, no.
I mean, what was interesting about what just came down was there were two other things that was decided. One, they weren't going to deal with sanctuary cities. Boy, that really must have gotten Donald Trump furious. But then what kind of maybe made, and it wasn't, this wasn't Trumpish, but it was the idea of liability with cops, that they could have taken up something to look at some of those liability issues and they chose to punt.
Qualified immunity.
Qualified immunity. Exactly, right at this time. And that's not necessarily a Trump issue. I mean, again, what's interesting is the two decisions today, the one about sanctuary cities, no thank you, we're not going to discuss it, and this one about employment, these are things that are very important to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump really got slapped around a lot by the Supreme Court today. So, I mean, I have to be a happy camper about that. But
Second Amendment case also they sent back.
Yeah, the Second Amendment.
Yeah, it's really Second Amendment. It's amazing. But I do have to ask one quick question before I let you go, and I'm so glad I got you today, Caitlin Burns. You write, the new rule was released on the anniversary of the shooting at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Do you think that was planned?
Oh yeah, 100%.
You know what they must have? They must have a calendar out. Who can we really piss off today? Who can we really tick off today? I mean, I can't even imagine what that calendar looks like, but that they are so artful and evil is just so shocking to me, because in a lot of ways, it's almost like, how much salt can I pour into a wound? Yeah. Let me figure out which day to pick.
Yeah, I mean, we saw it with the Trump rally in Tulsa that was originally scheduled for Juneteenth, same thing. Yeah. The one thing that I've learned covering this administration for all these years is there are no coincidences, unfortunately. As much as we all would like them to be coincidences, I just can't believe it ever.
Well, I'm going to tell everyone, you are a coincidence today. So I am very grateful that I reached out to you at Vox. I hope you come back on. I hope every time you come on, we're both smiling, because it's another great decision that comes down that expands right and protects people. And oh my God, it's wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And we'll see what happens between now and August. Yeah. Let's hope this rulemaking doesn't actually go into effect. So thank you again.
Thank you for having me on.
This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and the producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow. Hang on.